Hello, I'm Linda Huey, and this is Meet the Doctors, the show that lets you hear what doctors have to say about their lives, their work, their passions, and what they foresee for the future. Today, we'll be speaking with spine surgeon Alexander Bazzulli of Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. This episode of Meet the Doctors is brought to you by Complete PT, Pool, and Land Physical Therapy. Whether you're trying to prevent knee surgery or recovering from shoulder, hip, or back pain, Complete PT offers you the most advanced pool therapy in combination with traditional land therapy. You don't need to know how to swim or even get your hair wet. The 92-degree saltwater pool soothes muscles and joints and helps reduce pain immediately. Visit CompletePT.com. That's CompletePT.com. We're here with Dr. Alexander Bazzulli, and I've known you for a while now. And some of the things I know about you is you went to Stanford undergrad.
That's correct.
Yeah. Then you went to UCI for med school, and you did a fellowship at Jackson Memorial, and that's one of the hardest ones in the world to get into, isn't it?
It is. It is.
Because there's only one person there. They only choose one.
Yeah. That's a pretty rigorous program.
Yeah. And then after that, then you did another fellowship with Children's Hospital in Miami as well.
Correct. Miami Children's Hospital did a fellowship in scoliosis surgery for young children and adolescents who have spinal deformity.
Mm. And now you're here at Cedars-Sinai. And how long have you been here?
I've been here at Cedars, or part of the Cedars ecosystem, for about 8 years.
And I've known you for almost all of that time.
That's right. Yeah. I had the pleasure of knowing you for that long.
And, thanks. Yeah. Same here. And the reason I want to talk to you today is I just have been so enamored every time I've talked with you about the thoroughness and the thoughtfulness you give to everything that you're doing, that I want to share that with our listeners here on Meet the Doctor. So welcome. You're our first person on Meet the Doctors podcast.
It's quite an honor. I appreciate that.
So one of the things you told me about in one of the first times I talked with you is how you chose spine surgery. You were talking about how you were operating on live sheep, on their heart valves, and that you saw that the stakes were so high that there was something you loved about that.
Correct. So I was drawn to basically the significant technical challenge of surgery. And in my opinion, at the time, cardiothoracic surgery, which is heart surgery, and neurological surgery, like spine surgery, were, I think, two of the hardest things you could do. And there's a lot at stake during those surgeries. Mm-hmm. And there's no margin for error.
Right.
And whether it's a sheep or a human being, there is a life in the balance.
Yes.
And that's, I think, ultimately, that's a very humbling task in life. And to be able to use one's skills and talents, as it were, in that kind of endeavor, I think is very rewarding. But at the end of the day, it's also very humbling. You'll never meet a very experienced surgeon who is cocky, so to speak. The most experienced surgeons are the ones that are very humble.
And why is that?
Because they're tempered by experience and what they've seen and what could go wrong. Mm-hmm. And it gives them, to be able to survive that challenge, gives them a sense of equanimity and calmness and I guess humility.
Yeah.
That's the mark in my experience of a seasoned or experienced surgeon.
That they don't have an arrogant, I can fix it attitude.
Correct. Because as you go on in life, in your career, there are things you can't fix, cannot fix. And no matter how hard you try and how good your intentions, that's not to say that there are mistakes made. There are limitations to the human body on one hand and the surgeon on the other.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why it comes down to, especially for what I do, spine surgery. Surgery is really last resort for those whose lives are basically ruined by whatever's gone wrong in their spine. And you've tried everything you could for them non-surgically. And by the time they do sign up for surgery, it's really because they're at their wit's end.
Well, I've heard you say that 90% of all patients with back pain don't need surgery.
And that's correct. We'll see that time and time again. They'll come into your office swearing that they need surgery.
They want something to make the pain go away.
And you send them to physical therapy or you send them to have injections done, and 3 months later, they're fine.
Is 3 months about as long as you will wait to see if someone's going to improve?
We'll wait as long as we have to, and that's really where the art comes in and experience comes in. Mm-hmm. When you've seen thousands of patients, you begin to predict something about that patient when they come in through the door. You can tell this is a patient who eventually will be part of that 10% that needs some kind of surgery, versus you'll know that this patient's just having a bad time for now, and then 3 months from now is going to be fine, and you both are embarrassed that you even thought about doing any kind of surgery. Yeah.
And so the kinds that generally do fit that 10%, are they more structural, like tumors, or what other things?
So tumors is part of it. Mm-hmm. Tumors is one of those things where obviously you don't wait. It's that's life and limb threatening.
Yeah.
But for the overwhelming majority of things that we see, which are classified as degenerative issues, meaning wear and tear of the spine, the ones that eventually go on to surgery, they come into your office after months or maybe even years of struggle with everything. Physical therapy they've done, and it worked a little bit, but not quite enough. Injections they've done, medications they've taken. And what it all comes down to is they tell you, I can't live like this anymore. It is really a quality of life breakdown for them, whether it affects their ability to do what they love to do in life, like hobbies, or whether it affects their ability to make a living for themselves or their families.
Yeah.
That's what compels them to move forward, to have whatever the structural issue is fixed.
So I once had the pleasure of watching you do an artificial cervical disc replacement, that rather than fusing the cervical discs of the neck, you now are replacing the disc. And it was quite remarkable to watch the intricacy with which you folks did it, because there were two of you doing it. Can you describe what that surgery was and why it's now done outpatient, meaning that people walk home, they walk out the door that same day?
Correct. So there are two paradigm shifts in that surgery. The first being that for a lot of the things in the spine, the wear and tear of the spine, we would basically meld two bones together as part of fixing the spine. Mm-hmm. By all measures, that's a pretty crude way of approaching an issue. That's like thinking, well, if my hip has arthritis, I'll just fuse my hip. Or if my knee has arthritis, I'll just fuse it in place. And that's what we were doing with the spine. And we still do that for some things. But for most things, I think that's a pretty draconian and crude way of approaching things. So about 5 or 10 years ago, artificial disc replacement came to fore, wherein instead of fusing two bones together, we would fix what was wrong between them. And that's most often the disc. The soft gelatinous sort of cushion between two bones wears away. Right. And so nowadays, instead of taking that out and fusing the two bones on either side, we take the failed disc out and replace it with some sort of synthetic disc, be it synthetic in material or mechanical. Either way, there's motion still preserved between those two bones. So that's a huge paradigm shift in our profession, and patients do quite well from that. And most importantly, the rate at which they will require subsequent surgery is much less. The second paradigm shift is how we do those surgeries. Spine surgery traditionally has been sort of synonymous with big, huge, high blood loss, sort of long recovery surgeries.
And now?
And now we're doing what used to take 5 or 6 hours in about 30 minutes.
Incredible.
Not all surgeons, but you know, the surgeons committed to what I'm coining rapid recovery spine surgery, wherein you come in to an outpatient setting. We leverage the fact that we have often less than 5 cc's or 5 millimeters of blood loss. milliliters
what was
of blood
it in
loss.
The bigger surgeries? Compare it to what? Five
they
mils?
Used to be, the same surgeries used to be hundreds of milliliters or cc's of blood loss. Now there's hardly any blood loss. So we'd leverage that ability into doing these surgeries in smaller, cleaner, intimate settings, mm-hmm. where a patient comes in, has a surgery, and literally goes home.
So by cleaner, you mean not in a hospital, which
not
are notoriously
hospital.
Places with hospitals. All kinds of things growing.
Hospitals, first and foremost, are scary.
Yes.
They're big. Mm-hmm. They handle, nowadays, the sickest patients.
Yes.
And the most complex surgeries. And even though spine surgery is complex surgery, we've honed our abilities to do them in a setting where that kind of hospital setting is a little bit of a overkill for, mm-hmm. for a lot of patients. Mm-hmm. So those two paradigm shifts, preserving motion and doing surgeries in a way that leads to rapid recovery, same day surgery, I think that's benefited patients significantly.
Yes, and then last March of 2017, you told me that it was one of the first artificial disc replacements, L4, L5, that you knew of. And I went home and called around the country, and I couldn't find anyone else that had done one yet. So as far as I know, it was the first. Okay. Did you find that out to be true?
Correct. So
good.
We're doing in the lumbar spine, which is the back, what we're doing in the neck in terms of replacing discs. Obviously, the neck is a smaller area of the body, so it's traditionally it's easier to operate on in the outpatient setting. What was a little harder for us to get our minds around is how do we operate on somebody's lumbar spine mm-hmm. from the front in the outpatient setting, and that's for a number of technical factors. But and one of the levels of the back, L4, L5, which is the sort of the next to last level in the back, mm-hmm. for various anatomic reasons is a little bit challenging. But again, there we are fortunate to be working with some of the best what we call vascular surgeons. These are surgeons who get us to particular parts of the body around anatomy. Without you even having to think about the anatomy.
So and they gain access for you to be able to do your work.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they do it really well. And mm-hmm. again, they do it with, once again, minimal blood loss and minimal dissection. The so-called minimally invasive spine surgery. And the L4, L5 level was sort of the last challenge mm-hmm. For us. That traditionally surgery is done in the hospital setting, but now we're doing them routinely in the outpatient setting.
So you've done more since that first one?
Several more, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And they went home the same day.
They go home the same day.
They must be amazed. Do they walk out or do they?
They walk out. I think per policy, they're supposed to be wheeled out. Yeah. I think they're wheeled and then they stand up and
get in their car.
Walk into their cars.
Oh, man.
And 5 years ago, you would have laughed me out of the room if I told you.
I called somebody and I said, are you performing outpatient L4, L5? Artificial disc replacement, and yeah. somebody said that would be malpractice. Yeah. That was 4 years ago. Someone yes. thought that was, you know, because you were ahead of your time. You were right. leading the way on that.
Yeah.
Have other doctors started to follow in your footsteps now?
Almost everyone is now. everyone that's part of a particular generation of surgeons.
Yes.
So if you consider the surgeons that are really senior, they're probably set in their ways. And but the ones of my generation and maybe the generation after mine. We have a responsibility to our patients to innovate.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, to innovate within limits of safety and reason. And clearly, we wouldn't do something that we considered unsafe. But if there is a particular skill set and talent and technological breakthroughs in the way we do surgeries, we're obligated to bring that to the table. And so many things that are done now are considered taboo or quote-unquote malpractice in medicine, but in today's time, they're considered standard of care, and that's what we're trying to establish. We're trying to establish a standard of care that leads to better patient outcomes, better satisfaction, and ultimately in a healthcare system that's really fixated on delivering the most with the least amount of resources is better for the healthcare system.
We'll be right back with more from Dr. Alex Rizzulli of Cedars-Sinai after this. Meet the Doctors is sponsored by Helen Cycles, a full-service bike shop serving Los Angeles County for over 80 years. If you're in the market for a bike, you want to buy your bike from a shop that has great service. Bicycles need to be serviced and maintained on a regular basis for safety. You want a relationship you can count on with the shop where you buy your bike. Helen's cares as much about servicing your bike and keeping you safe as it does about the sale of a new bike. Their tune-up packages and excellent repair service will keep your bike in perfect working order. Go to helencycles.com. That's helencycles.com. Now let's return to our conversation with Dr. Alex Rizzulli, spine surgeon at Cedars-Sinai. Now, you once told me that you were concerned that this country, America, was going to fall behind the rest of the world because we weren't being able to be as innovative in the healthcare surgical field as other countries because of various decision makers, the insurance companies, government, and others. Do you still feel that same way?
We have already fallen behind.
Oh.
If you look at some of the prominent journals, which is the body of literature that surgeons draw upon and for experience and also share their experience, so the scholarly work, the body of scholarly work, much of that or most of it is no longer coming from U.S. institutions.
Where's this coming
from? Overseas, European.
Mm-hmm.
A significant amount is from China.
Mm-hmm.
The spirit in those countries, it's an ethic, it's a culture in those countries, is innovation first. The spirit in this country is process first.
Meaning what?
We're a country obsessed with process. For example, if I want to start a new research project here, I have to propose it, and it takes about a year to get approval from the institutional review boards called IRB.
Mm-hmm.
These are the
yeah.
A body of professionals that monitor what's done and what's not done in the spirit of protecting the patient. But a year's time is centuries as far as scientific advancement is concerned. And that sluggishness writ large, the FDA, mm-hmm. the sort of the governing body of everything, all devices and technologies that are approved and used on patients, can take even longer and demand a significant outlay in terms of dollars for innovators that are trying to introduce a new technology. Very little is done anymore in this country to facilitate the scientist or the innovator or the physician, all in the name of protecting something. And their intentions are good. They're trying to protect the consumer or the patient.
But what have to change for us to be at the forefront again?
More resources. I'm all for protecting patients. That's my livelihood. It's
mm-hmm.
my life is my patients. But if you have a new technology and you want to share it, the review process should be expedited, should be immediate. There should be people running to you to help you either
mm-hmm.
confirm or sort of refute whatever it is you're trying to innovate.
Is that IRB a governmental organization?
Or IRB is usually institutionally based, but they're
meaning
one
per university?
Per university uh-huh. or per wherever it is you're working
mm-hmm.
or hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But they're part of a multifaceted culture of investigational review, basically a vetting process that society or governments or hospitals or various institutions impose on whoever's trying to make some discoveries to make sure the discoveries are safe and that they're not
yes.
hurting people,
yeah.
which is necessary. But there is a limit to how much that process can affect innovation. And so smart societies are able to balance the two carefully. And we were one of those societies, but I think we've lost our way.
Mm.
All we really need to do is recalibrate process versus innovation, and we can do it. But like most other things in life, it requires a dedication of resources.
And will. Yeah. And I know we were talking about the possibility of using AR, augmented reality, or VR, virtual reality, in the surgical suite. Have you begun doing that yet? Do you know anyone who has?
I don't know too many people who have, at least in spine surgery, but we've already begun investigating the feasibility of that. So augmented reality in its most basic form is essentially overlaying on your field of vision. So what you see, overlaying on what you see, digital information from various sources that quote-unquote augment or enhance your ability to perceive what is in front of you. And so in the case of surgery, it would be, say, an x-ray of that patient's spine that's overlaid on what you're looking at. So instead of my having to take x-rays during the surgical procedure or various other imaging studies, I'll wear goggles that basically overlay a previously acquired x-ray or a CAT scan, which is a three-dimensional x-ray or an MRI, onto the patient as I'm operating on them.
Have you tried that out? Have you seen what it looks like?
It's in its rudimentary form, and it's going to take a lot of technological wizardry to do it. And so I'm in the process of working with a couple different companies that are active in this research to bring that to fruition. But again, that's going to take a long time.
So what are you hopeful about happening soon that will be an advancement?
Soon, what's really happening soon is that the push for minimally invasive surgery in the outpatient setting, that's, I think, going to become very popular for various reasons. Patients love it, doctors love it, and I think the payers, the organizations that pay for patients to have health care are
the insurance companies.
Because the cost of doing something in the outpatient setting is a fraction of what it costs to do it in the hospital. Some are not very happy about that trend, and hospitals are one of them.
You once told me that you thought that skill and conscience were the two pillars of your philosophy as being a doctor. Could you explain that?
Right. So conscience, in my opinion, allows you to be a healer. Skill allows you to execute your intentions in a way that makes your patient better and, more importantly, doesn't hurt your patient. Conscience without skill can sometimes have bad results, and skill without conscience means that essentially you're a machine or a robot. That's one thing that all this talk about artificial intelligence and deep learning and machine learning hasn't been able to conquer, and that is this undefinable, intangible, nebulous thing called conscience, which so far appears to be uniquely human. I think the best healthcare providers, the best healers, are able to combine the two. And that's something I aspire to as well.
So what do you see as you look forward 5-10 years? Where do you see spine surgery going?
Spine surgery in 5-10 years is going to be as follows. It's going to be highly evidence-based. In other words, whatever techniques or surgeries have a track record of not working or being of minimal value are not going to be practiced. Surgical techniques that are based on evidence of significant patient improvement, such as artificial discs and minimally invasive surgeries, will be practiced. The operating room is going to be significantly enhanced in terms of digital aids, such as augmented reality or things of the sort, things that probably we can't even imagine right now. And this push for rapid recovery. Patients don't have time to convalesce for 3 or 4 or 5 months. They want to have surgery and they want to be back to work ASAP.
Yep.
And that's going to exceed the bounds of surgery. It's going to require good surgical skill and excellent post-operative care, such as physical therapy and occupational therapy. All of those are going to be perfected and essential to this rise of what's called rapid recovery spine.
Now, what is your ideal patient? What does that person look like? Obviously, someone who's going to be compliant and do what you ask them to do, but what else?
The ideal patient, first and foremost, has reasonable expectations. they know that their body is broken down and they want it fixed. They also know that results aren't always 100%, that they will still have pain even after surgery, and that's the truth. Some people are perfect after surgery, but most have a little bit of pain, and I'm talking maybe 1 or 2 out of 10 on the scale that we use, of a scale of 1 to 10.
So they're going to, they might end up with a scale of pain on the level of 1 to 2 for the rest of their life.
For the rest of their lives. And mm-hmm. maybe sometimes they have no pain. Sometimes they'll have up to, say, a 2 out of 10 pain. That's our typical patient after surgery.
And now, is this something that a doctor typically tells his patients, or they usually say?
A good doctor will. A good doctor will say, this surgery will benefit you, but it's not 100%. You won't be perfect.
Yeah.
You'll be much better than you are now. You'll be able to do all the things you want to do, but you're probably not going to be pain-free.
So reasonable expectations. What else would you like to see in someone?
Second is they defer to the doctor. Mm-hmm. The doctor, they treat the doctor as their partner. And so in being deferential to the doctor in terms of plan and outcome and trust in what the doctor has to say, there is a good patient-doctor bond that develops. So the ideal patients have a tight bond with their doctors.
And how does the doctor earn that from a patient?
They have to level with their patient.
Mm-hmm.
They have to treat their patients as though they are part of this partnership. I never tell my patients what they have to do. I give them options, and I tell them what those options are and what they can do, but not what they have to do. And at the end of the day, I tell them what I would do
there
if I
go.
Were in their place.
Yeah.
And I can promise you, if your doctor doesn't want to do on him what he's recommending to do to you, it's time to find some other path. I think that patient-doctor bond is even more important than I think than anything else.
Yeah, it's what carries people through, is knowing that they have a valued partner in a challenge that they're facing.
Right.
Yeah. Now, what are the most common questions that patients ask you when they come to see you?
Most common question they ask me is, what would you do if this were you?
Oh, that's a good one. That's how you develop that point of view.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you don't want to treat patients any differently than how you would want to undergo the process. Most of the time, my response is, you know, try something other than surgery right now. Do mm-hmm. physical therapy. Do these injections. Do these exercises. But sometimes I see patients where there's really no way around the fact that we have to fix things. Otherwise, their lives will be ruined.
We don't want that. No. You don't want that. Because no. I know you're such... I've seen things that patients have written about you and said about you. So I know that you're a beloved doctor here. I'm sure there must have been 1 or 2 times in your career that you thought, oh, no, things went desperately wrong. And then how do you recover from that?
So things go wrong in terms of a care plan or a plan of action, and the best thing to do is to level with patients. Say there's this complication. Let's say the patient has an infection after surgery, or let's say their bones didn't heal in time and they have to have another surgery.
Mm.
You describe to them the limitations of the process. The human body is an extraordinarily complex thing, and there's so many factors that affect how the human body reacts to any kind of manipulation,
mm-hmm.
surgery being one of them.
And then one final question for you. I want you to tell me about one of your favorite surgeries. It just was a dream come true.
One of my favorite surgeries.
And a great outcome, a successful outcome.
Sure. Many years ago, a young woman, newlywed, fell out of a building.
Oh, no.
A couple stories. That's close to what we call a fatal injury. I think the fact is that a 3.5-story fall is fatal. So this is a 2-story fall. And she suffered a neck fracture,
mm-hmm.
and she was paraplegic, meaning that she couldn't move her legs. She was brought to the hospital, and I had to operate on her immediately. We did so by doing a neck surgery on her, and essentially removing the shards of bone out of her spinal canal and wow. stabilizing her spine, basically fixing it.
Mm-hmm.
And she was able to move her legs the next day, and she walked out of the hospital a few days later.
That's a great outcome.
That's a path. That's a life path that could have been significantly different.
And you were a young doctor then.
I was a young doctor then.
That was one of your first trial by fires.
That was one of
trials by fire.
That was one of our first surgeries that I did outside of the purview of what we call training. And training, by the way, to become a spine surgeon is about a 10 or 15 year process. So by the time you're out of training, you're already pretty seasoned. But nevertheless, there's no one looking over your shoulder. And but in any case, that was a rewarding surgery. Still humble about the whole process, though. It's important to be because of what you do and what's at stake.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you for being our first doctor on the Meet the Doctors podcast. It was so great to see you again.
It was my pleasure.
We've been speaking with Dr. Alex Rizzulli, spine surgeon at Cedars-Sinai. You can find him at rizzullispine.com. That's R-A-S-O-U-L-I, spine.com. If you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode as we speak with the brightest minds in medicine, research, surgery, and much, much more. I'm Linda Huey. You can tweet to me on Twitter at Linda Huey. That's LYNDAHUEY. Say hi or tell me who you'd like to hear on Meet the Doctors. Thanks to production assistant James Cowan and to Tom Struther for audio post-production.